Last time we had post-phenomenology as the approach. It's one of the approaches in philosophy of technology. Today we have another approach, but one that's also responds to post-phenomenology and also to the philosophical tradition, one could say, with the work of Paul Ricoeur. I'm not going to say too much, because otherwise I already give away all the good content for the vessel. But so it fits in the lecture as another approach, and one that's connected with post-phenomenology. It's also fits with something else, namely the collaboration Wessel and I have on this topic, narrative technologies. So this is research directly coming from the desk where it's made, so to speak, to here. Also from the publications that are just out, one in human studies and then now one in philosophy and technology. So I thought this is nice because it shows immediately a kind of approach that's very contemporary, very, you know, being done now, and also because it responds to other approaches in philosophy of technology, it gives you some kind of idea of what's going on in philosophy of technology today. So that's why today I invited Wessel Reyers to give a guest lecture. For those who weren't here last time, where he also did a contribution, Wessel Reyers is visiting me on an Ernst Mach fellowship here in Vienna. And so that enables us to intensify our collaboration, but also to work together also in terms of not only research, but also teaching. And I think I'll stop here, because otherwise I'll just talk the whole lecture for a while. So I give the floor to
you. So welcome, everybody. I'm happy that you decided to show up to listen to what I have to say. It's always nice to see that people actually want to listen to a story, even though maybe you need to as well for your studies, of course. So today we are going to discuss the outcome of a number of theoretical frustrations that both myself and Mark as well, I think that we had, that we have in the tradition, overall tradition of philosophy of technology, but also kind of beyond, in the sense that there was already a critique coming from philosophy of technology towards theories in STS, for example, those provided by Latour and Pinch and Biker and so on. So in that sense, it's a response to what is already there, at the same time, it's also, of course, something that we ourselves develop. So that's also why I really want your critical input, because it's always a bit, I mean, I'm fully biased, of course. I think it's a nice approach. Maybe you think it's totally crap. If so, please tell me, and also tell me why you think that. That's always very important. In a way, we can also not claim too much... for ourselves, because actually what we, in a very basic sense, are doing is introducing the work of Paul Ricoeur in the discipline. I'm not sure, who of you has already worked with Paul Ricoeur in some other context? Yes? And what did you read? Or
It was about language. It was about language,
okay.
Rhetoric, and the textuality of philosophy.
Okay, yeah. So that fits pretty well. Did you have to read any of his works? Or?
Yeah, about a paper, but not a whole book.
Did you read Narrativity and Time?
No.
Maybe? No? Okay. Oh, well, I mean, he wrote so much, so it's incredible. I mean, I haven't read everything that he wrote yet, unfortunately.
But it's true, he's mainly known from philosophy of language, I would say, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about language.
Yeah, he's the I mean, from a personal perspective, I would say that he kind of continuates... Well, I mean, and he is very diverse, but in a way he also continuates Heidegger's project of building on this idea of a philosophical hermeneutics. Because in the 20th century, he's one of the most important hermeneuticists, I would say. And at the same time, he's also a very important figure because as one of the only philosophers, contemporary philosophers, he really makes an effort of bridging the divide, so to say, as many people see it, between analytic and continental philosophy. So where you see that many philosophers are really stuck to one side, and I would even say that in philosophy of technology that's often the case, that, for example, philosophers are only discussing problems in the context of their in their tradition, Ricoeur forces himself to step out of this tradition and uses, in one single chapter, for example, uses theories of continental philosophy, even though, of course, you might question the labels, but you can see that there are different academic traditions. So he uses, on the one hand, for example, theories of Heidegger, and in the same chapter, he might use analytic philosophy such as the one provided by John Searle, for example. He doesn't shy away from that. And that's also a point of departure for myself and also for Mark, in the sense that I've always been interested in both sides. So, for example, in understanding technology, a really valuable figure for me is John Searle. Even though I totally disagree with him, his theories are very, very inspiring and unfortunately too often neglected, I think, in certain theories of philosophy of technology. So, to start, I would like to start with a threefold critique of what theories of technological mediation have been thus far, so to say. And then thus far, I refer to what we previously discussed, what is called the empirical turn. So, in terms of traditions, there is what one might call the classical philosophy of technology, which includes figures such as Heidegger, Marcuse, Ellul, and so on. And then there is the empirical turn, which happens in the 80s, which is associated with also the influence of science and technology studies, such as the theories provided by Latour, but also Pinch and Biker, and so forth. And there the idea was that philosophy of technology, as we also discussed last week, should concern itself more with particular technologies instead of grasping the whole issue as one monolithic kind of phenomenon that has a certain influence on the way that we are in the world. So, even though this switch was very influential, important, and maybe most importantly led to for the first time, maybe a fruitful crossover between, on the one hand, philosophy, science and technology studies, but also actual design. So what you see now, what didn't happen in the 80s and what does happen today, is that philosophers and designers can work together in one group. Maybe considering that is a really, really big advantage of where we have come since the empirical turn, we also need to reflect on it critically. And I would say, considering technologies of technological mediation, of which I think post-phenomenology is one of the most important ones at the moment, there are three main critiques. I hope you can still remember of last week what the theory more or less entailed. So I will actually go through each of these critiques separately to show why they are important to consider. And actually the first one, which is very contemporary critique, written by Jochem Zwier in a very recent paper in Philosophy and Technology Journal, which is open access. You can find it if you're interested. Is maybe one of the best ones, I would say, because it goes to a very fundamental problem of the approach. So, as you might recall, Don Eide characterizes post-phenomenology by stating this kind of formula, saying that it's phenomenology plus pragmatism. And the question then, of course, is how do these two... So if you merge two different traditions, can you do so without negative consequences? Is basically what this paper is asking. So what happened actually when you merge these two approaches? And, Sria and et al., so to say, they argue that the... So the phenomenological part is more or less clear, I think, since last week. But then the question is, what does it entail that post-phenomenology is partly a pragmatic theory? And then, first of all, they say that the phenomena looked at from a perspective of post-phenomenology actually entails... what they call these human technology relations, but those human technology relations entail both the relata and the constituents of the relation and the process of constitution, so to say. So, as you might recall, these kind of schematism, you have the I technology world, and that is then shaped by means of a particular context. So, for example, where Heidegger, when with the example of the hammer, was mostly putting focus on a way of being that is expressed, or is revealed by the practice of hammering. Post-phenomenology takes this as a different approach, where they say that the world, which can, for example, be the wall in which you are hammering a nail, is brought into context with the eye, the subject that is hammering, and the technology as constituents of the entire relation, human technology world relation. So that is one way in which pragmatism is, so to say, included in this phenomenological approach. So they call it like pragmatic content. So you're, so to say, this formalized relationship gets contents by means of these pragmatic instances. And then the second one is also that what Don Eide argues in his book very explicitly is that he wants to have an understanding of technological mediation that is useful. And of course, use is a central point in pragmatism, but it also has certain consequences if you reflect on it from the perspective of phenomenology, and then especially from the Heideggerian perspective. Because basically what they argue is that by taking these two approach, or taking these two points of departure which separate, so to say, post-phenomenology from the phenomenological tradition, they make some crucial mistakes by taking these relationships between entities, so to say, at the ontic level. So if we give contents to these relationships, we still refer to the I, the thing, and the world, as in a pragmatic or in a particular context. So in that way, you relate to this entity, which is the relationship, on what Heidegger would call the ontic level, instead of the ontological level. Which kind of goes against the claims that post-phenomenology tries to make, because it tries to say that it makes claims at the same level as, for example, where Heidegger puts his notion of inframing. So that is the first critique. And the second one that flows out of this problematic is that taking the philosophical analysis as such, as something useful, so something that can be used to for another end, so to say, renders kind of the philosophical analysis itself susceptible to this notion of enframing, as a gestell in Heidegger's words. So instead of so by taking this attitude and positing your analysis in this way of seeing it useful for another end, you're actually succumbing to the idea of enframing. So those two critiques are quite critical for considering post-symbology. So, and then there's a second critique, which is mostly formulated by Mark, actually, which is that by turning to the things themselves, so engaging in this material hermeneutics, as Don Eide frames it, through the process of getting there, the part of hermeneutics has almost disappeared. So these kind of schemes, these human technology world relations have been formalized, but there's no way in which the process of interpretation through language, as we can understand hermeneutics, still has a place in post-phenomenology. And this is partly due to actually a dismissal kind of Heidegger's account. And as you can maybe recall, it was done on the basis of basically these two things. So both, first of all, seeing technology as a monolithic single force, and second of all, as by dismissing this idea that there is an essential difference between pre-modern and modern technology. But by doing so, they really retreat to kind of the Husserlian position, and that's also what you can really see in the way that they explicate these human technology world relationships, as in schematisms that involve this notion of bracketing. So you take these constituents, and the existential nature of one of them becomes they become, so to say, so basically what this says is that the hermeneutics part of project that Heidegger, or that Eide, was trying to develop has been lost in the process. And third of all, a critique that kind of also came out of our discussion of last week, we can see that there is kind of a missing part, which is especially discussed by Joni van den Ede in a really interesting paper, is what he calls the being with others relationship. So, as you might recall, all these schematisms revolve around the individual kind of perspective. So, the I technology world relationship revolves around the eye using a hammer, hammering a nail in the wall, which is interesting, so to say, but it also leaves out certain human technology relationships, so to say, that are really difficult to account for from a post-phenomenological perspective. One of them, where actually my personal frustration can come out of, is the phenomenon of money. So one can ask, for example, if we relate to the world through money, so to say, what kind of human technology world relationship are we actually talking about? Is there really an individual I involved in this process, or is there something that what John Searle then relates to is called like collective intentionality, that is kind of covered up by this approach in post-phenomenology? The we somehow disappears. And if one takes the idea of collective intentionality seriously, and if one takes the idea of that an account of how individual intentionality relates to collective intentionality is necessary to include in any kind of account of technological mediation, then this is certainly a gap in the theory, or a problem. So then, the question is how to resolve this conundrum, so to say. How to get an account of technological mediation that both incorporates the mediating force of language and of the social, so to say. So it gives an account of how the individual relates to the collective, so to say. How can we give this a place in theory? And so one of the ideas is, of course, to kind of expand on the existing model, so to say that, for example, instead of bracketing the I and technology world, to say there's a we technology world relationship, but the added information gained from such an approach is very dubious. So we have been kind of, we forced ourselves to kind of look outside of this current paradigm of post-phenomenology, and that is where we found a very inspirational kind of grounding in the work of Paul Ricoeur. See, Mark. And actually, we were not the first. David Kaplan, in a paper in 2007, already explored the value of Ricoeur's theories for understanding technological mediation. And one can see it like this. There is a rich tradition of hermeneutics, which also spills over and interacts with different disciplines such as linguistics, literary theory, historiology, narratology, you name it, which is really, really grounded on this idea of mediation. So the question in this discipline is not so much how do technologies mediate the world, but it's very much how do texts, such as books, stories, treaties, you know, you name it, how do those things mediate our understanding of the world, of our social reality? And Ricoeur explicitly posits the text as a paradigmatic model, so to say, for what he designates as meaningful action. And so going from there to our use of technologies, the step becomes a little bit more obvious, maybe. In the sense of seeing or understanding of meaningful action does not only happen through the use of text, so the reading of text, the writing of text, but one could similarly say of technologies that our meaningful interaction is very much mediated, or a concept even of meaningful interaction is very much mediated by the technological devices and systems we use and in which our lives are embedded. And as a kind of point of departure, we kind of took this idea of what Ricoeur posits as emplotment. So the notion of the process in which a plot is developed in a story, so to say, which he explicates as the configuration of characters and events in a meaningful whole. And why does this resonate with our idea of technology, perhaps? Well, first of all, one could say that in talking about technology, such as in design literature, engineering literature, etc., etc., the way that technologies are given meaning, apart from the technical concepts, is through narrative as well. So the ways in which several components interrelate with human action, for example, in human media interaction discourses, you can see this process of emplotment very much happening in the literature. But at the same time, we could say, we could look at it as Ricoeur does, as more of an ontological construct, in the sense of our technological systems and our action conducted through these technological systems. You can see, for example, the traffic, which is a system which is not only mediated by technologies, but is very much a social technical system, in the sense that it's very hard to distinguish between the social norms that are imported into these systems and the technologies that make them, that enable them. So in this way, we could say that such technological systems also kind of emplot human action, and that's kind of our point of departure. So if this is a valid premise, then we could actually use Ricoeur's work to understand technological mediation. So, how can we then approach this idea of textuality? So as Ricoeur also kind of acknowledges, even though we can take narrative as a ontological point of departure, but it does not mean that it is the same unifying monolithic concept as, for example, Heidegger's notion of enframing. It is rather something that surfaces through our use of technologies, but in differing degrees. And we will come to that as well later on in the presentation. So one can, for example, ask, so to what extent can we say that the bridge, as discussed, for example, by Heidegger, crossing the River Rhine, really emplots human action? And, we can argue that it does, but to what extent does it actively do so, for example, in a way in which a novel or, for example, a story that we relate to in the first through reading can do so. But then, if we look at the way technology has developed, in a similar way as we can look at the way in which literature developed, in which our storytelling capacities have developed, we can say that the textuality, the extent to which technological mediation approaches this mediation paradigm of texts, we can see that throughout the development of technology, historically speaking, that there is a kind of convergence towards this textuality of the text in terms of technologies. So when we compare, for example, this Heidegger's example of the bridge crossing the River Rhine with modern information and communication technologies, we can see that the latter are much more textually shaped. So language as a constituent of these technologies, so to say, becomes a much more important aspect. Okay. So how does Ricoeur treat with this idea of emplotment, so as he says. So emplotment for him is defining for the idea of narrative. And he approaches this from, he conceptualizes this process of emplotment according to three different stages, so to say. And these stages basically conceptualize what happens, or conceptualize the moments at which you start reading a text, the moment during reading, and the moment at which the text has been read. So it kind of conceptualizes this temporal phenomenon of reading, so to say. And he conceptualizes these three stages by means of the concept of mimesis, which is explicated by Aristotle as being the active process of imitating or representing something else. For example, in Aristotle, in his Poetics, he discusses, for example, the genres of tragedy and comedy and theater. to explain this notion. So these characters on stage and the script they are following, or the narrative they are following, represents, actively kind of imitates or represents the world of action, so to say. So we relate to it by means of our understanding of our own world of action. And the way it is done so is by means of the plot. In Aristotle, mythos, which is then defining for the narrative that shapes the interaction. So, the first stage that he tries to describe is the entrance stage of starting or engaging in an interaction with a text, so to say. So here we're still talking about his model of the text. And there he says that, borrowing mostly from Heidegger, is that whenever we interact with a cultural artifact such as a text, the text only becomes known to us, or only becomes understood by us, by virtue of it being already mediated by this narrative understanding of the social world. So we understand its concepts, its language, etc., etc., because we already have, so to say, a cultural repertoire that we can operate through, that allows us to understand it in the first place. So that basically entails that any interaction with such cultural artifacts, such as a text, departs from a prefigured time, which is a temporal being in the world that is situated in specific narrative structures that are that apply to the reader, so to say, and to the writer as well. So that is the first kind of point of departure. But then it becomes really interesting. I mean, the first is kind of basically all the way borrowed from Heidegger, so that's not really the kind of innovative addition to this idea of philosophical hermeneutics. But then he treats with this mimesis II moment, which is the moment of configuration. And this is exactly where the notion of plot gets a place in the theory. Because it is, as Ricoeur says, an organization of events and characters in the meaningful whole that we call the narrative, or also the story, but there is this distinct meaning of story and narrative. The story is more of referring to the entity, so to say. So, for example, a book, the story of a book, whereas narrative relates more to the process. So that's also why we can refer to narrating also as a verb, whereas storying doesn't really make sense. So thinking about this in terms of technology, the way that we relate to certain technologies, one can understand it through in a certain way. So, in a similar way. So, for example, taking this idea of the traffic again, which is kind of the social technical construct, and or relation, or use, so to say, use context, for example, of the technological artifact that we call a car. Of course, whenever you take your first driving lesson, for example, before then you already have a certain prefigured understanding. So this prefigured time already plays a role. The car for you is already an understood cultural artifact. You know what it's used for. You know how it plays a role in your social reality. You even know kind of the basic concepts. So, for example, traffic rules, etc., etc. So there is already a pre-given understanding. But only through using the device, you gain the particular understanding of, for example, the traffic system as a car driver. You gain this understanding, which you wouldn't have before you entered into this use context of using an actual car. So, and then also we can consider how these kind of how the use of this technology actually configures this the understanding of the traffic as a process of involvement. And going back to recur, we have to then be very careful of looking which is the decisive criterion for talking about the correctness of a plot. So this is also where, for example, recur differs decisively from people such as John Searle, because John Searle would put meaningful action always into the category of representation. So the only reason why, for example, a declaration such as Donald Trump, hereby I declare Donald Trump to be the President of the United States, that such a declaration constitutes a social reality in the words. I'm saying John Searle, but I'm not sure whether all of you have read him or familiar with him, because otherwise it's maybe a bit too much of a detour. Who has read John Searle? Anybody? You okay? Okay, one. Okay, maybe that doesn't make any sense to make this detour. Okay, never mind. Just taking into account that there's a distinctive difference between what recur designates as followability and representation. So what this basically means is that in contrast to propositions, the correctness of a plot is not decided by means of representation as a criterion. So maybe to kind of revert to one of like the interesting kind of discussions in analytic philosophy, where Clark Kent is Superman, and you can have different propositions with different meaning while they refer to the same person. Considered as a text, this kind of difficulty almost kind of dissolves in a practical relation to a text. In the sense is that a misrepresentation in a storyline can make sense as long as the storyline itself is followable. And to kind of also get to this kind of difference between parts of a narrative that allude to representation and parts that don't, we have to take the concept of time into consideration. So one of the basic questions that recur asks himself is how do texts mediate or conception of temporality? So how do they mediate or conception of time? And he says that in a text, in a narrative, there are different two main different dimensions of temporal organization at play. One of them, he says, is the chronological dimension. And the chronological dimension is a very simple sequence of events. So, for example, if you ask a kid on primary school to write in a storyline, for example, you would very often see this kind of structure. So first he went to the supermarket, then he went home, then he went to his work, then he went eating, and then he went to bed. So that's like what recur calls the chronological dimension of narrative, which is a very important dimension, but it's not the only one. At the same time, he says, there is the achronological dimension, which allows the reader to jump between different times. So, for example, you have in stories, you have, of course, flashbacks, flash forwards. Very importantly, maybe even more importantly, in a story, one of the achronological dimensions is to have a sense of ending. So, if you have a sequence of events, the sequence of events can continue indefinitely, so to say. Chronology can essentially continue indefinitely, whereas a story or a narrative, more importantly, a narrative can have a sense of ending, where the whole of the narrative, all its propositions, so to say, are leading towards a conclusion that is being accepted by the reader. And as the third achronological aspect of this achronological dimension is that it allows whoever is interacting with the text or whoever is interacting with this cultural artifact to oscillate between events and the plot as a whole. So an event can, for example, be a proposition, but then because of by virtue of it being a narrative, the reader can relate this event to the overall structure of the text, which itself is not a proposition. So going back to the way that we can conceptualize technological mediation by means of this construct is that the textuality of technologies, as we discussed before, can be put into this hermeneutic distinction that we conceptualize, which is that the extent to which technologies can actively configure this narrative time, so this narrative understanding of temporality, can be seen as a hermeneutic distinction between one technology and the other. So basically, just as texts can have either a chronological dimension, they're always both present, but there is a degree, so to say. So it can enforce a chronological way of narrating, but it can also enforce an achronological way of narrating. So that's a hermeneutic or spectrum that can be captured by this hermeneutic distinction. But at the same time, another very interesting aspect of the way that texts mediate human understanding that Ricoeur discusses is by considering the difference between historical narrative and fictional narrative. If we have the world of action in which human affairs occur, the question is then how do these both very distinct modes of narrative relate to this same world of action? So on the one hand, you could say that historical narrative, the aim of historical narrative, is standing for things or states of affairs or occurrences as they actually happened. On the other hand, one could say that fiction doesn't have this restraint. Fictional narrative allows for what Ricoeur designates as imaginative variations. And again, these are always interwoven, he says. So it does not mean that we have some absolute pure instance of historical narrative on the one hand that absolutely depicts events as they really happened, and on the other hand we have a fictional narrative that is absolutely divorced from our actual world, but they represent these two extremes of the spectrum with varying degrees. But how can we understand these two types of narrative? So one of the very important things that Ricoeur is discussing is how do we actually explain things through these different types of narrative? And then he mostly discusses historical narrative. So how does historical narrative really stand for our actual past? And it needs to be a relationship of explanation. And he does commit to this idea that there is causal explanation in historical narrative, but that it is distinct from so to say, for example, or deterministic causal relationships such as we know in physics. And he, for example, he discusses the very known example when we talk about historical causation of the murder of Franz Ferdinand as in relation to the start of the First World War. And he explains it as saying that even though this explanation reveals a necessary cause for the cause of for the event or for the unfolding of events, it does not reveal a sufficient cause for the unfolding of the plot. And this is a very important aspect of his account, considering that we use it for the understanding of technological mediation, because it exactly frees us from this idea of technological determinism. So if we consider not the historical narrative, but if we consider the technology as a paradigm of narrative structures, then we can say that even though happenings can be, or that the way technology mediates the world can be understood by considering necessary causes, it does not need to include the understanding of sufficient causes. So, but then how does this way of explanation work in historical narrative? Whereas it needs to take a certain distance from the contingency implied in our daily world of action, so to say. So it is, as Ricoeur says, there is a certain process of abstraction going on in historical narrative. And how does this work? He says that he comes with these concepts of instead of having an organization of events and characters in a plot, he says that there is a construction of, so to say, quasi-events, quasi-characters in a quasi-plot. And how to understand this? Because, of course, it doesn't really explain anything yet. Here I only have the explanation in terms of technology, but one can understand, for example, in a historical narrative, if I say that in September 1939, Germany attacked Poland, you all understand what it means. But if we try to explicate what this event entailed, then we are going to refer back, so this recurs as to the world of action. So what actually happened, so to say, behind this abstraction is, for example, that there was a German officer who had contact with the Reichstag, he made a phone call, he ordered his troops to go into to cross the border, etc., etc. So what this means is that these constructs such as Germany, Poland, and many of these constructs that are used in historical narrative are basically abstractions from the world of action. And what he then calls are quasi-characters in quasi-events that are forming a quasi-plot. So what we can learn from this is that in narrative, so to say, according to Ricoeur, abstraction happens like in this way, by the construction of these quasi-events, quasi-characters, and quasi-plots. And we looked at it from... we took this idea and discussed technological mediation, right? So how do technologies actually do the same thing? How do they construct or confront us with these abstracted quasi-events, quasi-characters, and quasi-plots, and how can we reconstruct, so to say, the cause of events by referring back to the cause of action? And that is something that is still important future kind of research thing. So Ricoeur talks about this idea of retrodiction as a method to do this, so to go from this abstract level back to the world of action. And he doesn't really explicate this method that much, but it's very interesting to look at that more closely later in our research project as a way of, for example, going back to the extreme abstractions that are that we are confronted now with in the realm of financial technologies, back to the world of action that they mediate. Okay, so now we've gone through the most important part, then the Mimesis 3 is, as I told before, the third movement in this process of narrative configuration or narrative mediation, so to say, and it is referred to by Ricoeur as refigured time, and that basically just indicates that this indicates the moment in which the world of the text or the world of the technology, so to say, intersects or with the world of the technology user or developer. So basically this means that when we have used, for example, the car in the first time of our lives, how did this, so then the, or understanding of the traffic that we already had before, so this prefigured understanding then merges with our configured understanding of the traffic, as you can, I hope you can understand. So then, basically, we have a new understanding of our social world by means of interaction with the technology. Okay, so where does this bring us? This brings us to these kind of two different distinctions, what we call hermeneutic distinctions, by which we can understand technological mediation. Basically, we say that... Basically, we say that one of the distinctions implies this notion of textuality. So, to what extent a technology is similar or comes closer to this paradigm of the text as a model of human action. So, and then we can say that. So, how do we put concepts to categorize this distinction? That's how we put the words passive and active. I'm not sure whether that those are the best words. Maybe that's something that we really need to reconsider. But maybe textual and non-textual is much better, or textual and less, whatever. So that's something we still need to reconsider. But what it basically means is that the more passive a technology is, the less the way it mediates human understanding can be related to this paradigm of textual mediation, and the more it does so, we call it it kind of actively configures our narrative understanding. So the more it kind of comes closer to this paradigm of textual mediation, the more actively it can configure our narrative understanding. So that's one distinction. The other one is between what we then call engaging and abstracting. So this basically relates to this distinction between historical and fictional narrative. So to say that the more technological mediation comes closer to this idea of fictional narrative, the more it can be said to engage through these imaginative variations, engage the user or the developer, and the more it, an engagement has to be understood as in engagement with the world of action, so to say, and the more it comes closer to this idea of historical narrative, the more it abstracts from this world of action. So that's basically what we came up with. And just going to illustrate it shortly to you. I'm not sure where we are, actually. Oh, okay. Still some time. I'm shortly going to illustrate it first by mentioning four examples. And then we're going to go deeper into another example that actually plays a central role in one of the two papers that will be sent to you on the intranet or whatever you're using. The first is the bridge. So for the first two examples, I'm especially going to recall the way Heidegger treats them. So the bridge and the hydroelectric power plant. First of all, we can say that these instances, these examples of technologies, in comparison with contemporary developments of ICTs, are still considered to be less textual, less closely related to the paradigm of the text than these contemporary technologies. So, in that sense, they both fall into this category of, so to say, passive, even though we have to maybe rephrase the word, narrative technologies. But where they differ is whether they can be structured as engaged on terms of the engaging narrative technology, or rather than abstracting narrative technology. Now I can explain this in the following way. So consider the moment at which the bridge has been built. So the bridge crossing the River Rhine. At that moment in time, it does configure, so to say, the narrative understanding of the people that are using it, so to say. So this new system of trade, of cultural exchanges, of mobility that emerges will have will alter the prefigured understanding of the people that are going to use this bridge. But as Heidegger also explains, over time, over the passing of generations, the bridge, so to say, becomes part of this prefigured understanding of reality. That's also why we refer to it as more or less passive narrative technologies. Especially considered in time, it becomes part of this prefigured understanding. And in a sense, it is compared to the hydroelectric power plant, which Heidegger treats as this proto idea of enframing, we can see that if we compare both technologies, the technology of the bridge, so to say, directly shapes the world of action. So that's basically what it does. So, for example, the merchant trade that goes on, the people crossing the bridge, the one family visiting the family on the other side of the bridge, is directly related to shaping this world of action. Well, compared to the hydroelectric power plant, it is in its being there as part of the world, it is not directly related to the world of action in which it is configured. So it might gather around the energy contained in the water of the River Rhine to be transported over hundreds of kilometers and being used in a far distant place. So this network, or in which it kind of plays a role, these relations have been very much abstracted. So even though it might mediate, for example, the power supply of somebody living 200 kilometers away from it, this mediation has become hidden behind this kind of abstraction, so to say. So that's how you can see how the power plant can be designated as an abstracting technology, whereas the bridge can be designated as an engaging technology. And with ICT, so then we go to the textual side of things, where technologies become more and more, or have a much greater capacity of interacting with our narrative understanding. We have different considerations. So, for example, certain video games are maybe the most prototypical ideas of very textualized technologies that really present you with a narrative, so to say. So the narrative is interwoven into the technology design. And at the same time, they offer, with varying degrees, of course, they offer a sense of imaginative freedom for the user. So you can engage with the technology as some sense of open-endedness of the narrative it configures. And there's some that are really radical with this. So, for example, this is Fable, where you can, like, the way that you shape your character into the narrative is very much oscillates between different types of characters. For example, you can be very good or you can be very evil, depending on how you shape this world of action within the narrative. So there it becomes really clear how these kind of technologies can be conceptualized as both very close to this paradigm of textual mediation and at the same time being very close to this idea of engaging narrative technologies. And on the other end of the spectrum, what we are going to talk about for the rest of the lecture is one of my kind of personal obsessions, which is blockchain technologies. I'm not sure whether you've heard all of about that. I mean, you've all heard about Bitcoin. Basically, the blockchain is the underlying technological innovation. We're just going to go through it very shortly in a bit. But as I will explain in the next slides, these technologies are very paradigmatic, so to say, for the other end of the spectrum. So they are very close to the paradigm of textual mediation, but at the same time, they abstract from the world of action to a very large degree, and I will show you how that works. And then we also have some extra consideration that does not fit into our model, but is still important to consider, which is also something or it does fit into the model, but it's not a hermeneutic distinction, which is something that also Ricoeur discusses, which is also something that is important to consider when we talk about technologies. Ricoeur says that makes this difference between, on the one hand, commentary, and on the other hand, narrative configuration. And another scholar, Carr, he says that he talks about second-order narrative and first-order narrative, which we kind of adopted. But the idea is basically the same. So what is the idea? The idea is that whenever there is a narrative narrative mediation at play, so for example, there is a certain novel that a reader can interact with, and this novel becomes part of prefigured time, so to say, so it becomes part of our shared culture. Then there are different ways of seeing in which this novel finds entrance into our understanding of the world. One of them is through reading. That's very simple. So that's basically covered by this whole process of narrative configuration. But at the other hand, there's also, as you might know, there's people that have never read, for example, 1984, but are still using it to say something about the world. And that is where this idea of commentary enters the stage. So there's a second order narrative. A reader and somebody using a narrative in order to construct a commentary. Those are certainly different ways to relate to a certain narrative structure. As Ricoeur recalls, they have the same structure, so even if I construct a commentary, this commentary will still have a structure that adheres to the way that we construct narrative configurations, but they relate in a different way to the same narrative. So, if you compare this to technologies, you can say that it becomes very clear that, for example, anybody who has used Bitcoin or who has been part of the Bitcoin developing community has a very different understanding of this technology than a layperson who has only heard about it through the news or through superficial kind of recollections of what Bitcoin does or what Bitcoin is. That does not mean that it is a better understanding in any qualitative sense of the world, but it is more proximate in a sense to the narrative configuration itself. So this is not a hermeneutic distinction, but this is still an important thing to take into account if we talk about technologies embedded in society, where there are different people who have different positions with regards to the same technological mediation. Okay, so now, as an example, I will discuss blockchain technology because it's super interesting and exciting. So blockchain technology is the underlying innovation of the more familiar cryptocurrency Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is, what most people know about it is that it's used as an electronic currency. But it has a much broader field of application, which makes it very interesting. Because it kind of merges different features of textual technologies that we use in our social life. So it is not only a currency, it also can be used for, so to say, so-called smart contracts, which basically means that it can be used to exchange and draft contractual agreements in our social world. And especially it can also mimic, which is what's very important, it can mimic services that are traditionally only provided by government. So, for example, it can decentrally organize property rights systems, insurance systems, you name it. Everything that is, in one way or the other, based on contract can be organized through these types of technologies. And what is it? Very, very simply and very basically. Very basically, it is a public shared database. So in Bitcoin it's called a ledger. A ledger that's like a concept that's taken from banking. So in banking, in any bank has a double bookkeeping ledger, where there's your account, the account of your neighbor, and whenever there's money going from your account, your balances are changed. That is a ledger, but more basically, the blockchain is a shared database. So it does not need to contain transactions. It can also contain contractual agreements, even property rights, for example, with music, with electronic music files, etc., etc. So it is a more basic version of the idea of an account and ledger. And what is also different from a normal database and this public shared database is that the public itself, and the public has to be understood here in technological terms, not in terms of people. That is what makes it different. So the nodes of the network, which means that there are that there are many computational nodes. Anybody who's using a blockchain technology is part of the network, so to say. And the network as such, so all the nodes combined, provide for the computational power to guarantee the integrity of the database. So, whereas, for example, if you're a government, you have a central database and you have to protect it with a firewall, with an antivirus, whatever stuff, cybersecurity measures. And in this in this sense, all the different nodes together guarantee that nobody can override the transaction history. And that is a very important notion to take with us in the analysis. So, first we're going to consider it. Maybe I have to go a little bit fast because now I have some question time. Okay, first we can consider it from the perspective of prefigured time. So if we take this model that Ricoeur has given us, so to say, how can we understand the advent, so to say, of blockchain technology as being part of a social world in or prefigured understanding of the world. That is basically to say, how does it relate to our historical being, so to say. And first of all, one can say that we enter already in a relationship to this technology out of the idea of a cultural repertoire. So one of the ideas that was very prominent for the advent of this technology was the idea of having an electronic currency. So what was already included there was our pre-given conceptualization of the monetary system, or the pre-given conceptualization of what money means to us. And then there's historical events that have in which this development was embedded, which are the most notably the financial crisis, and at the same time the advent of a movement called crypto anarchism, which basically was a driving force for the development of these technologies that were in their early stages mostly utopian ideals. And what it basically, so there are two kind of ways to, for example, to capture this in our historical narratives. First of all, we can say that whenever, at the moment in 2008 and 2007, when our financial system collapsed, and out of this collapse of this very abstract structure of derivative trades, algorithmic trading, we certainly started talking again about the world of action. So, for example, about the integrity of bankers, about the way in which greed on Wall Street has caused the crisis, etc., etc. So, you can already see that even without theory, people start referring back to the world of action to explain these abstract historical events. So, first of all, that. And second of all, there were these happenings that related to this, the advent of crypto-anarchism, that were instigating events for the rise of Bitcoin. So one of the very important events, for example, for its success was the moment when, I think in 2010, when the US government, through credit card providers and payment services, blocked every financial transaction to the WikiLeaks platform. And then, at that moment, Bitcoin was the only alternative. And that has really pushed up the success of the currency, so to say. So far the kind of background, so to say, the prefigured understanding of how these technologies became part of our understanding of the world. But then, of course, is the question. So it is not only these historical events or this historical understanding that leads to our understanding of the role of these technologies. No, it's also through use, because we deploy them in our daily business, because we start to use them as money, to start to use them as smart contracts, etc., etc. It's also because of that that our understanding of the social world gets changed. And then we can use these. Wait. Okay. These hermeneutic distinctions that we discussed before. So first of all, it is, as we showed, it is very textual, or as a technology, it comes very close to this paradigm of textual mediation, which basically means that it actively configures, as Ricoeur puts it, characters and events in a meaningful whole, so such as a transaction. When we talk about using blockchain technologies as currency. And one of the basic, so this is quite interesting, one of the basic problems that is actually tackled by the advent of these technologies is a problem of time. It's also very much central to the literature. So one of the basic problems that they try to address is what they call the time stamping problem. And what does the time stamping problem entail? It entails that whenever we have a digital system of exchanges, so transactions you name it. Usually there is the possibility for me as a person who is doing the transactions to duplicate my transaction to somebody else. So for example, that means that at the same moment in time, I can send the same amount of money to two different people. And which is a very huge flaw or basic problem in decentralized systems. And the notion of time here is very important because we are not able before to see in which chronological order which transaction took place and to verify this through this system of public of integrity of a network, of network integrity. So, what does this mean for the way in which either kind of the chronological or the achronological dimensions are enforced in this narrative understanding of a technology? Well, as becomes very clear already when discussing this timestamping problem, we can see that the chronological dimension of the organization of events and characters in a meaningful whole takes almost absolute, it's never really absolute, takes almost absolute precedence over any achronological dimension of time. So that means that the moment of transaction and the sequence of transactions becomes determinate for the meaning of these transactions. To maybe put it in other words, for example, the use of blockchain technology in what is now called the Internet of Things. I'll have to explain it a little bit. So, as soon as our devices are all connected to, and much more importantly, dependent on network connections, it becomes possible to embed them, so to say, into these automatic contracts that are publicly enforced. So, for example, you can consider that you're renting your washing machine. You have your washing machine in your house, and it's connected to the Internet of Things. And basically, what this means is that, for example, you can connect the use of the washing machine with your payments. And through this idea of smart contracts, so you can come to an automated to agree on an automated contract between the user of the washing machine and the provider, which basically says that if the user does not pay monthly such and such amount of money, cryptocurrency for example, then access to the use of this device will be shut down. And as you can see that in this process of automation, this temporal dimension, so when money gets paid, when it gets shut down, and gains precedence over any other understanding of the occurrence, So in time. So, for example, where in a normal contractual situation, you could still interfere with this chronological dimension by explaining a contextual occurrences that kind of validate the defiance of the rule that was temporarily enforced by the technology. In this case, that becomes impossible. So then the question also becomes, like, so if you turn this philosophical kind of reflection into a normative reflection, which is a question for another time, should we then apply this principle to all our kind of aspects of social life? Or maybe that's a problem. Okay, then we come to the last point, which is this idea of abstraction, which is already alluded to by one of my other favorite philosophers, Georg Simmel, who talks about distancing instead of abstraction, but he basically means the same thing, which basically means that we are moving towards strictly representational account of social reality. And how can we understand this? So, as in historical narrative, our access to blockchain technologies is mediated through this kind of abstract entity. So you as a person, for example, you are related to an address. And events, for example, through smart contracts, are related to abstract events such as price fluctuations of digital assets. And those entities together, or those quasi-entities and quasi-events together, configure this quasi-plot. So this quasi-plot could, for example, be, as in the case of our washing machine, a rule-governed execution of a smart contract. However, of course, this does not mean that there is no escape from this abstraction, as, for example, Heidegger would say, would call it, when he talks about enframing, because Ricoeur introduces this idea of retrodiction, so that we can refer back to the world of action in order to explain how things happened and why things might have happened, or why we might want things to happen differently. Okay, I've been talking way too much about way too many things. So, let's get to a conclusion and questions. So, anybody ask me questions? Comments? Ideas? Frustrations?
Yeah, well, at the end, wasn't that retrodiction, the problem that wasn't so much elaborated in Ricoeur's work. Or you mentioned it as a side note.
So indeed, Ricoeur says that retrodiction is used in narrative to go from abstractions back to the world of action.
But
how it happens, he does not really explain that. So that's indeed.
Well, yeah. And in the context of technology, if this is an essential point, and it's not so clear, or maybe it can be developed, but it seems quite difficult to the translation from an abstraction to a real event.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what you, for example, see then in this example of the financial crisis, when there is an abstract event such as the crisis itself. Or an abstract plot, so to say, so there's a crisis itself. You can see that already, even without theorizing, you can see that people are doing this. So they are referring back to, for example, the behavior of investment bankers. They're referring back to the way the city of London is organized, that kind of stuff. So there is a referring back going on, but how this really happens is indeed a question that remains slightly unanswered. Yeah.
So it's more or less an explanatory function rather than something that would prevent the actual translation.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think you also...
What I find very interesting is the idea of making contracts without a state or some power being behind that.
Yeah.
So would that mean the first time in history you would be able to make a contract without a sword, so to say?
Yeah.
Behind it.
Because if you approach it from social contract theory, there is no punishment, active punishments like for example Thomas Hobbes argues about. So the sovereignty of the system does not happen through punishment but through exclusion. Through the threat of exclusion. So, for example, if you consider this idea of having your internet, the device that is connected to the Internet of Things on a blockchain contract, this means that you are conforming to the system, you're conforming to the contract by fear of punishment through exclusion. So. The only thing that would happen if you don't deliver on your promises in the contract is that you're excluded from the system. So that, for example, your washing machine just doesn't work anymore.
Okay, so I see, and but that is a little flaw in it, because for really big contracts where it's about a lot of money, this would really don't.
Oh, for sure, yeah, no, that's
violating
true.
Violating the contract, sorry.
Yeah, no, it would not help for peace treaties or war declarations, or probably, or
small things, very useful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michael.
Well, there is a pretty crucial link, I think, between narration and user manuals. Mm-hmm. I missed the first part of your lecture, unfortunately, so I do not know if you mentioned it.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
You did. Perfect. Uh-huh. Okay. So, what about, for example, the blockchain technologies and smart technologies and those smart contracts? Are there any user manuals which tell stories of how to handle, how to interact in certain situations? Or is there maybe a new challenge for creating new ways of narrative structures in user manuals because of this networking background, whatever, smart technologies,
well,
WhatsApp, Facebook?
Of course, there is like in many ICT-related environments, the manual merges with the interface, so to say. So there's no... So that means that the steps are mostly represented while using the technology, instead of having these two different entities, or these two different relations, one with the interface and one with the manual. They're like merged into one thing. But certainly with blockchain technologies, this also happens. Yeah. So whenever you're setting up your wallet, or whenever you're using an exchange, you enter into this manual mode. Where the different steps are explained to you.
Are there also emerging smart contracts?
Emerging smart contracts?
Yeah.
How do you mean?
Maybe contracts which emerge, which change step by step. So when you do something, when there's maybe a new technology, whatever, then the contract changes and adapts the new situation.
Well, in a way, you could think of contracts that emerge out of automated systems, such as algorithmic trading systems. There you could have emergent contracts, in the sense that there's no human being contracting.
Yeah.
That could happen, yeah, of course. Yeah. But then, in human context, I wouldn't see how it could be emergent. Or you would say that there is like a collective process going on from which a contract emerges, or...
Well, the question is, there are a lot of stories told, actually. Many technologies which develop very fastly, and many lawyers have really problems to regulate it. So maybe the future of contract technologies or contract theory will be an emerging form.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe algorithms always create in a concrete situation a new form of contract related to a concrete new technological application. I don't know about the ethical consequences, it might be a little bit problematic, but it would be an interesting idea.
Yeah, it would really depend on the idea of the meaning of the notion of emergence. So if it means emergence by virtue of not having being dependent on human interference, that might be problematic. Yeah.
I have another question about blockchain technology. Do you see that the Bitcoin technology in the future replacing other currencies? And regarding that, how is the value of Bitcoin determined?
Well, I don't think, I'm not sure whether it will like replace. So that's a political question, of course. Like, so for example, here is a big conundrum with regards to the nation state. So as long as the nation state will exist and we have national currencies, no, it will not take over. It will take over some, like partly, but not entirely, because then it will just be forbidden. But in this kind of growing cryptocurrency universe, Bitcoin is and will remain prominent, probably. So there's like people that say that it will be the gold standard of cryptocurrencies, which is quite thinkable, yeah.
How is this value determined?
Oh yeah, sorry, how do the exchanges work? So the exchanges work basically the same way as any monetary exchange works, every currency exchange. So there's just a demand for Bitcoin, there's a supply, or and there's a certain supply, and this is being weighed against the supply and demand of other currencies.
Yes, but aren't other currencies so dependent on the nation state, as you said, and dependent on the economy of the nation? For example, the euro is very dependent on the EU.
Yeah, but with states. Of course with currency exchanges, it doesn't really matter. So there's always like so it depends on whether there's a pact or a free floating exchange rate. So whether a currency can depreciate or appreciate versus another currency depends on whether the exchange rate is pegged or is fixed or is free floating. And most currency exchange rates are free floating at the moment. So basically, like the way Bitcoin relates to euro is the same way as the euro relates to the dollar. There's no essential difference between that. Any other questions? Comments? Well then, if you have any questions later, you can always send me an email. And then I would like to thank you for your attention.